are very well represented here. So I'd like to welcome all of you. We eagerly await the information and knowledge to impart to us. I remember a couple of years ago, about 15 years or so ago, Parliament organized a workshop for members of Parliament. The authorities that we were concerned that as soon as members arrived at Parliament, they were ambushed by all sorts of people selling their wares. Motor vehicle companies, people selling beach houses. So people, on arrival in Parliament, everyone wanted the latest Mercedes, the latest Volvo, those were the most beautiful girlfriends. And then soon people were struggling to pay their accounts. When this workshop was organized and they brought people to come and give the requested financial advice, I could hear the hum amongst members, and on closer listening, I heard one member say, I thought they were going to give us more money. Not for people to tell us what to do with money we don't have. So we look forward to today's session. I'm sure we'll be able to, okay. Well, welcome to all members, interested parties, stakeholders. My boss on my left says that we commence with a presentation, a register by the Auditor General's office. Is that correct? We are in your able hands.
Good morning, Honorable Chairs and members. thank you very much for the invitation to address the committee this morning. The purpose of today's session is, as outlined in the program, just to brief the committee a bit on the role of the Auditor General and how we'll be engaging with the committee going forward in your term, and how we can assist you in your oversight function. We would like to start off with a short video clip. It's a 10-minute video clip, which will link up to the presentation that we will be doing. The presentation will be done mainly today by Mr. Paula Shira on my right here, and she will be assisted for a short while on my far right by Raisang Motele, and then my colleague to my left from our parliamentary offices here in Cape Town, his name is Jean Laraki. Let's have a look at the video, and then we will go over to the presentation, and then we will also allow some time for questions and engagement with the community. Thank you, Jesus.
Thank you. I'm very mindful of the weather outside. It's a bit cold. So when there's a radio, it's not an invitation for people to consult their ancestors. Your eyes should kindly remain open.
Can you go to the center?
is for the IT person coming here.
I think let's rather than do the slide presentation and then this video clip is also available on YouTube. You know, because we're taking it to the people. So unfortunately, I think if we don't struggle to listen, then we're going to lose the message. But we can always try and do it for you at a different venue when we meet again for the triple R or whatever. It's just 10 minutes of your time. I think we'll take in contact.
Okay.
I will then ask my colleagues to start with the presentation. In the packs for members, there's a couple of documents. There's what we call a mock audit report. It will benefit members to maybe just read through it once, because it will familiarize you with the contents of a audit report. And you'll see there's some parts that you don't always have to read. And then there's also a little handout which my colleagues will take you through now. Can we just open that on the screen if we can?
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and members. I'll be going through the notes to the presentation of the audit report. It's recommended that this document be used throughout the year for the understanding of how we prepare our audit report. It also provides guidance as to how the reporting process got about and what major topics are discussed in the audit report. Going to the third page of the audit report. The audit I'll be presenting from the smallest slide from the pack. The audit report includes the emphasis of missing additional matters paragraph, which doesn't have an impact of the audit opinion, but it's just to draw the users of the financial statements to those matters. Where the emphasis of matter paragraph draws the user's attention to the matters presented to financial statement matters, and then the additional matter paragraph to which draws the attention of the users to other matters which are not financial statements related. The audit report, the audit report does not cover the entire annual report, hence there's a paragraph in the audit report which refers to the pages which have been covered as part of the audit. With regards to predetermined objectives, the audit opinion on predetermined objectives is not yet included in the audit report. However, the conclusions are provided to management with regards to the predetermined objectives, and the achievement of targets is included under additional matters, which is highlighted to the users as good administration and does not necessarily imply service delivery. And then on internal control deficiencies, significant findings are reported as a result of internal control deficiency. And the following paragraph sets out fundamentals of internal control which should be implemented with regards to leadership, financial and performance management, and governance. The following descriptions explain the SMART criteria which is used to report on predetermined objectives, which is the SMART criteria. Specific, the main and required level of performance can be clearly identified. Measurable, the required performance can be measured. Achievable, the recommendation or action is realistic given the existing capacity and timeliness required for implementation. Relevant, the required performance which regards to what needs to be done is needed to the achievement of a goal which is in line with the mandate objective. Time bound, the time period or deadline for delivery should be specified. Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'll take you through another 6 slides in the pack. Okay, if we all have it. So the purpose of this presentation is just to provide members with the necessary information and guidance on the role of the AGFA to enable them to effectively execute their oversight function. So if we go to page 5 of the presentation, we'll start with the audit mandate and process. Okay. If we look on the audit mandate, we have the legislative requirements for the AGFA and for the department or entity. For the AGFA, we are a Chapter 9 institution. You will find under Section 188. And in terms of the Public Audit Act, our mandate is also clearly defined. If you look under departments and public entities, in terms of Pearson A, under Section 38, Section 40, 51 and 55, that's where the responsibilities of the accounting officer are clearly stated. So if we go on the audit report, the other handout, in the fact there are 3 handouts there. Okay. On the first page of the handout, the accounting officer's responsibilities are clearly defined.
Thank you. We don't know the GFA mandate.
And it comes through.
No, usually I think that's workshop.
And at this point, I didn't even catch what it is. So please just let them. Can we go a bit slower? Because I want to go and pounce out of here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, honorable members. Let them go through the presentation. And then the aspects where members are not here, we left the requisite time to post questions. If there are areas that we want them to walk us through, we'll do so. I can assure you that by the end of our engagement, we'll be literally happy when we leave this place. So, fine.
Thank you, gentlemen. I agree. Although maybe you will see that we will as we go through the presentation, we will touch on the context again for you at various times throughout the presentation. Dipala will give you some more detail about the role of the Auditor General, and then we'll touch on a few key issues I think with regard to the responsibility of accounting officers. Let me quickly deal with the first slide. And then the panel will continue afterwards. So in terms of the constitution, the Auditor General is a Chapter 9 institution. Our key mandate is to audit and report. In the subsidiary legislation, which is called the Public Audit Act. The Public Audit Act gives you in a bit more detail what the requirements is, what the Auditor General should do in the execution of his responsibilities. Now, it varies. There are some aspects of the legislation which says the Auditor General shall. For instance, the Auditor General shall audit and report on the books of accounts of all national departments, all provincial departments, and all municipalities. That is a shall. The Auditor General must do that. Then the legislation says, and it's what we call Section 4.3 institutions. You will, in your next term, you will hear a lot about the reference to so-called Section 4.3 institutions. It refers to Section 4.3 of the Public Audit Act. What that means is that section of the Act says there are other entities which receive public funds, but in terms of legislation, are not audited by the Auditor General. But the legislation now says that the Auditor General can opt to audit those entities. It's, for instance, to give you some good examples, it's your major, some of your major public entities, Eskom, Transnet, many other public entities. The Auditor General can audit them, but they can also appoint their own auditors after consultation with the Auditor General. So the normal process is that they consult with the Auditor General on the appointment of the auditors, and that we then give guidance to those auditors on certain aspects that they need to do and focus on during the normal audit process. It's a requirement of Section 20 of the Act. If you look at a slide in the second column, so it's a requirement of the legislation that we focus on three key areas. We need to express an opinion on the compliance with the law and the regulation. We need to express an opinion on the financial statements where it fairly presents. In other words, the figure that you see in the financial statements is that fairly presented. Then we need to audit the compliance with laws and regulations. So we need to give the user a view whether the entity complies with the key legislation. And then very important, it's a requirement of the Public Finance Management Act that all entities must report on their annual reports on their performance against predetermined objectives. Each and every entity. So if you look at the annual reports of each and every entity, whether it's a municipality, whether it's a public entity, whether it's a national provincial department, the entity must report on its performance against predetermined objectives. So the third requirement is that the Auditor General must actually audit that performance information. So that's why if you look at the audit report, this mock audit report that we've given you, you will see that all the areas are covered in this audit report. On the first page, We deal, for instance, in this case with a qualification matter, and during the presentation we will take you through what is a qualification, when do we qualify, and she will explain to you in the first part of the presentation what is an emphasis of matter. Emphasis of matter is not, it's not negative reporting, it's merely just focusing the user on something that is already disclosed adequately in the financial statement. So it's very important to know that an emphasis of matter is not a life qualification. An emphasis of matter merely focuses the user attention to something which is already in the financial statement. So if you look at the first part of the audit report, it deals with the financial part. The second part of the audit report then has got the heading report and other legal and regulatory requirements. And here you will see reporting on the predetermined objectives and on the compliance with the laws and the plans and the regulations. And in the last part of the audit report deals with what we call internal controls. And my colleagues will take you through it. You will see that in case of negative reporting, we will highlight for you which good practices in terms of internal control have not been followed and which resulted in this negative reporting. That will enable the committee to focus on which aspects of e-control need to be worked on to enhance the audit, to enhance the audit outcomes. So that's in brief the key responsibilities for the GNO. You will see that later in the presentation, my colleagues will take you through a slide which will tell you that the Auditor General may do investigations, but it's not a must do investigations, for instance. The Auditor General may do performance audits, but it's not a must do. And they will also explain to you the difference between a performance audit and a audit for performance information. The rest of the slide then deals with what are the requirements of accounting officers, because it's very important to understand the requirements of accounting officers. And I like for you the key section, because in your preparation, you're going to have to get to know the public finance management act to a certain extent. And it's a very big piece of legislation. So we're trying to focus you in terms of what is key for you in that terms and in that piece of legislation to focus on. Section 38 and section 40 is key. It explains to you what is the general and specific requirements for accounting officers. It determines that an accounting officer, it is responsibility to make sure that the financial statements that are presented for audit are accurate and complete, that the performance information is accurate and complete. It determines that it's the responsibility of the accounting officer to make sure that there's a proper internal control environment. It determines when the accounting officer must submit financial statements. And then the similar section, the Public Finance Management Act, is split into two. The first part of the Public Finance Management Act deals with the National Provincial Department, and the second part of the Public Finance Management Act deals with the public entities. Similar but different legislative requirements. So you will get a section that deals with the requirements of national accounting officers, and then you'll get a section in the later part of the BFMA that will deal with what is the requirement for accounting authorities, which is a board. The board is an accounting authority for a public entity, and in the case of a national department, it's one person, but also a provincial department, it's one person. The director general is the accounting officer. That's the difference between the two. The rest of the slide to your right hand side just indicates to you that there's other key legislation in stemming from the BFMA, there's three regulations, and you will find that if you look at this mock audit report, you will see that we report on various aspects of non-compliance with other regulatory regulations or the Public Finance Management Act. So there's key pieces of legislation in terms of the BFMA and the three regulation that is normally focused on. We've highlighted them for you when we say that is the part two management arrangement, planning and budgeting. Planning and budgeting, of course, is something which this committee will also focus on in terms of from the oversight point of view. Then when it gets to the performance information, the reporting of performance against predetermined objectives, there's frameworks. So there's treasury regulations that requires those performance reports. But then there's frameworks which have been developed by national treasury, which entities must comply with in how do they do their strategic plans and how do they report on that performance against predetermined objectives. For instance, stemming from those frameworks is the requirement of the SMART principles, which my colleague has help with early on, and you will, and that's why we've got that little handout. It's something that we think can help you a lot throughout your whole oversight term. Take it always with you in your preparation. If you see that an entity talks about the SMART principles, or we talk about the SMART principles, you can quickly go back to the reference guide and say, okay, what is the SMART principle? Again, and that will help you a lot in terms of focusing on these issues during the oversight. I'll hand back to this follow then to take you through the rest of the presentation. But like the chairperson said, and I think what the honourable member also requested, is that this is not just a one-way presentation. We would like at the end of the presentation to have some interaction with the committee members to clarify any issue that you are uncertain about. Thank you, chairperson.
Thank you, sir. Shall we continue, madam?
Thank you. When you look on the next slide, this is what the regularity for this time. So we'll show you what we do and what we do not do. What we do in the past sector is to provide an assurance that financial statements are free from material misstatements. We record the usefulness and reliability of the information in the annual performance report, that on the predetermined objectives. We report on material non-compliance with relevant key legislation, and we identify key control deficiencies that should be addressed. That's the section on the audit report that Lawrence took us through, that has leadership, function, and performance management, and governance. And what the audit does not do, it does not guarantee a completeness and accuracy of all the information. We do not provide assurance that all applicable laws and regulations have been complied with. It does not identify fraud, and it does not provide assurance that credit delivery has been achieved. So if we move to the next slide, this slide shows you the regularity audit and what supports the regularity audit. We have a split between mandatory audit and discretionary audit. The discretionary audit would be performance audit, investigation, and special audit. Performance audit, this is where we just evaluate measures to ensure economic procurement of resources and efficient and effective application of the same. On the information system, this is an audit that is undertaken on the system by CAT. And then investigation, this again would be an independent process to prevent or detect fraud or crime in the public sector. Okay. Then there's special audit, again, this would be agreed upon procedures, for instance, on donor funding. So if we move to the next slide, it will take you briefly through the annual audit process. So how the process unfolds is we agree terms of engagement with management. This would be in the form of an engagement letter. Again, the same responsibilities of the accounting officer and the auditor general are outlined in the engagement letter. Then we will plan the audit and perform a risk assessment to identify which risk should be addressed. And then we will design and perform procedures to identify the said risk. At the conclusion of the audit, we prepare a management report. This management report is not published. It is, however, provided to the management of the entity and to the executive authority of the entity. Contained in the management report would be the findings and the reports and recommendations on the issues identified. Then we also prepare the audit report. This is published and is included in our annual report. Again, in the audit report, if there are any material findings or material non-compliance, these will be highlighted in the audit report. On the next slide, we can just look briefly on the performance audit. Now, as I stated earlier, the performance audit is just to ensure that resources have been procured economically and are used efficiently and effectively. I'll just take you through some of the findings that has been identified during the performance audit. On economy, there's one of the findings would be where the procurement bidding process was not followed, or whether contracts were open ended in terms of cost and time. When it comes to efficiency, this would be where the projects were extended because of lack of project management and monitoring. On effectiveness, this is where the project objectives were not achieved and deliverables were only partially achieved, or skills were not always transferred or transferred. Then on the next slide, we have the timelines of the audit cycle. On the 31st of March, this will be the financial year end of audit fees on BFMA. Then on the 31st of May, 2 months after the end of the financial year, the financial statements are submitted to Auditor General for auditing. On the 31st of July, the audit should be completed, provided financial statements were submitted on the 31st of May, and then this is where audit report is issued. On the 30th of September, 2 months after the audit report is issued, this is where the annual reports are submitted by the auditors to Parliament. And then in the last quarter of the year, or the third quarter of the following year, this is the general report, where the general report of PFMA are published. The next slide takes you briefly through the audit report structure, which you have your introduction, the opinion, the report on legal and other regulatory requirements, the internal control sufficiency, and if there are any other reports. This slide is the mock audit report, the internal contents in the mock audit report. And then on the next slide, I'll just take you briefly through the audit opinion and what they mean. So the first one is unqualified with findings on compliance and predefined objectives. So what this means is the financial statements do give a true and a fair view in all material respects out of the way findings on compliance and on predefined objectives. The findings on compliance would be, again, where the competitive bidding process was not followed. And then the next one would be qualified. This is where the financial statements do not really present in a way, but it's not so material that it is pervasive. However, an unqualified opinion cannot be expressed. And then the third and the fourth one is the disclaimer and an advert. Okay. So the difference between the disclaimer and advert is, with regard to the disclaimer, the auditor was unable to obtain evidence to form an opinion. That is, that would be in where the record keeping and things like that are not working effectively. With advert, if the auditor disagrees with the representations made by management. So with advert, if management has disclosed, there is information to support, however the auditor disagrees with the representation. Okay. And then on the audit of predetermined objectives, on the next slide, on usefulness, this is on presentation, measurability, relevance, and consistency. On reliability, as validity, accuracy, and completeness. So typically, the findings on usefulness would be where indicators and targets are not clearly defined, they're not measurable. And on reliability is where the information to support was reported will not be there, or it will not be sufficient. And then on the next slide, we're showing you the difference between an audit on predetermined objectives and the performance audit. Okay. The audit on predetermined objectives is a mandatory audit. It includes compliance reports and regulations. A performance audit is a discretionary audit. Okay. An audit on predetermined objectives reflects an opinion or conclusion on performance information. The performance audit, on the other hand, is factual and does not include the audit opinion. The audit on predetermined objectives is done annually as part of the regularity audit process. The performance audit is not limited to annual information and can have more than one financial year. It can be 2 or 3 days audit. The audit comes to determine objectives is done as part of the regularity audit process and by the regularity auditor. The performance audit is done by the performance auditor and may include subject matter experts. The audit on predetermined objectives reviews and confirms the validity and completeness of the information. Performance audit evaluates the 3 E's at organizational, program, and project level. 3 E's would be economical efficiency. And then the audit on predetermined objectives, the reporting is done at entity level and tabled in the relevant legislature. Performance audits also at entity level and tabled in the relevant legislation. We go to the next slide. This shows the audit report structure. This shows the good administration or clean audit. On the first one, we have financially unqualified financial statements. These are financial statements that do not have material misstatements. By material misstatements, we mean if any funding that identified after these financial statements are submitted for auditing and corrections are made, and corrections are not made, they still would not have been qualified. Then the second one is no material findings on compliance laws and regulations, and there are no material findings on predetermined objectives. Now that is good administration or clean audit. On the next slide, we've highlighted the best practices for the key controls that actually result in good administration or clean audit. I'll just take you briefly through the three key controls. Under leadership should establish a code of honesty, ethical business practices, and governance. And it should also exercise oversight responsibility. And then on financial and performance management, there should be proper record keeping of all transactions. And also there should be effective control over daily and monthly processing and reconciling of transactions. Under governance, typical things under governance would be an effective and functioning and internal audit. And to ensure that risks are periodically identified and addressed. Then on the next slide, we discuss the visibility of the AGFA beyond the mandate. So this is what the AGFA does beyond its mandate. It provides oversight committees in Parliament and all legislatures with briefings on root causes and recommendations on corrective measures to improve audit outcomes before the entity hearings. It also consults widely with stakeholders in the executive and legislatures prior to taking the general report that consolidates the audit outcomes of national, provincial, and municipalities. So, if we go to the next slide, we have the oversight model. This will actually talk through the next process, the B-R-R. If I can take you briefly to operational planning and budgeting. On the next slide. For the review consideration, what the committee needs to do is to understand the mandate of the entity, to determine if there's adequate budget and human resources to deliver on the mandate, to understand the clear link between budget and annual performance plan of the entity, and to assess whether there's adequate funding to execute the strategy. Analyze prior year expenditure, analyze prior performance against actual expenditure, and to determine to what extent budget was used to achieve performance. Also, the committee should do an assessment of breakdown of budget to ensure value for money. Okay. Then the other thoughts on this slide, talking about strategic planning, reporting, implementation, and monitoring. If we go to the next slide, this is the AGSA contribution to overdrive. So we provide briefings to the committee on audit reports before portfolio committee compiles them B4R. Update on progress of financial audits, in that we share audit risk and status of key controls. Before the APP is reviewed by portfolio committee, we discard the findings identified from the proactive audits of the previous type of debt department. We attend and provide clarity during public hearings. We do roadshows after the tabling of the general report. And we assist in building capacity to members. Okay, the next slide is the key timeline. This just illustrates the oversight cycle on an annual basis. The parliamentary briefings, the media briefings, the ministerial statements, and the B4R. Okay. The dates are detailed in the table. If we look on combined insurance level, model, sorry, I would just like to take you to the third level of assurance. This is where this committee comes in, the oversight portfolio committee. Okay. On the other end, the third level. So as an oversight committee, the committee reviews and monitors quarterly progress on the implementation of action plans to identify address deficiencies. Now this is where, on a quarterly basis, the entities will come to the committee to present what progress has been made against the audit action plan, for instance, and where they and to address the deficiencies that were identified, and where the entity has made a commitment, this should also be monitored. Now this is where the committee comes in on the combined insurance model. Now, if we go to the briefing process, the next slide just shows you the briefing process. There's the annual report, which includes the audit report and the performance report. Okay. And then there's the AGSA briefing notes. So what this means is when the committee will get the annual report from the entity. Included in the annual report will be the audit report and the performance report. The AGSA will provide briefing notes to the committee to assist with the process of reviewing the annual report. Okay. Then the next slide also still talks about the briefing process. And then on the next slide, we have the external applicable, which is the MFMA and the PMMA, and the federal regulation and the instruction notes. Thank you.
Members, comments, questions?
Thank you, Inspector. Maybe this is back to you, Inspector. You lost the answer that you would. Auditor General, like the Public Works Committee, then we're going to deal with the Public Works team. Also, as the presenter, we would see like the Public Works Committee, the department, so, but like it's general, come from Islam like you so. Of course, previously, I don't know which is something that is familiar for which you can presentation, how we are making them something before they are coming. For example, on page, I'm not a page, but oversight, key timeline, there is a parliamentary question, then people who are in a list. So I'm trying to say, maybe it's my poor understanding for which is.
Thank you and thank for the presentation as well. I just so good smart. I know during my time it was all the realistic. I don't know what I the inference between the reality and relevant on your heart so that I can subscribe it. Mm-hmm. So the other question just here, I just want to come and find out, you know, when the department comes to Ali, he was a strategic plan. It has been my impression that the strategic plan is being based on the pilot. Now sometimes I get confused if the department say we are running short of, we don't have enough funding. Then it becomes difficult for me because I thought whatever they plan is based on the funding. Why would they can't say there's not enough for funding? But the other one that I'm just missing, you know, we talk about the financial body opinion. And most of the time we hear this thing of clean audit. But when you talk about only four, unqualified, qualified, schema, and what happens? So when we come to really have this thing of waiting, what is just a month and another thing. Just when you do your audit, are people that you actually take some samples? Can it happen that maybe that financially you have missed something and you pick it up on the next audit? Does it happen? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Madam. The Honorable Move.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. That's a question of about some clarity on when you say what the audit does not do. If you don't guarantee completeness and accuracy of all the information, then what do you do? Because the idea is that you want to get to know what the problems are, but if you can't guarantee the completeness and the accuracy of all the information that is, Who should provide that accuracy? Who should provide the completeness, if not your responsibility? And the other thing is, you don't provide assurance that all applicable laws and regulations have been complied with. I don't know what it means. If you don't apply the audit process and apply them to the applicable laws and regulations, then what's the point? You don't identify fraud. I thought the idea was that you're going to look through the process and see where entities have messed up, where the money might have been misspent. And if you don't identify fraud, you report to other agencies that say, oh look, check out this process, I identified this. Okay, maybe you might not be able to provide assurance that said delivery has been achieved. Because that's not the responsibility, but set deliver goals with money spent, budget spent on particular activities. Now, if you cannot provide the assurance by set delivery, then what's wrong with the funding? Because the funding must be able to reflect on whether the delivery has taken place or not. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mama Sundi, Obo Paramesi. Okay. Thank you, Professor. Chairperson, I just want to run out from the AG's office. I know that normally once a year have the full briefing with the Auditor General himself. And the last two briefings, the Auditor General has promised that struggling departments will be assisted. But to our shock, the story that departments disclaimers and I'm not up to standard and not to be what they're supposed to do. As the office of the AG formed a team or is a mechanism to assist these departments, especially if we look at our municipalities, it's one of the things that is really getting us down above us, giving us a bad name outside in the other financial areas. As well as some government departments, state departments, such as, is there any mechanism or has a mechanism to put in place for assistance for these CFOs and departments as such, and not to say that you've now got a disclaimer or you've got a qualified report or all that. And also the point is, one of my colleagues has raised a clean audit. But you know, we've always thought of why is a clean audit, what findings, or what the sentence is in that. A clean audit is a clean audit. They should not be part of all that. And if you can just unpack your wording or meaning of a clean audit. Then on the three E's, I only heard about two E's. I want to find about the other E's. Then, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Amanda. Okay, before you respond, if I go to Honorable Jobo's input, she was basically articulating that the nature of the presentation that we have received thus far is generic. It lays down general principles. Good as that might be, for today it might be good to say that at the Audit General's office, this is the remit of our responsibilities. When we audit, we look at this. So it's general application to all departments. But if not possible today, it might be necessary, after you have articulated your general principles, taking people from the unknown to the known. Must also bear in mind that there are other members who have been in Parliament for the past 20 years, others for 5 years, others 10 years, others just been here for a couple of months. So the responsibility is to be able to put all members at the level where they can understand. So at the back of your mind, you have to remember that. At another level, perhaps at another engagement, it will be important to make the presentation portfolio specific, with examples that are relevant to the Department of Public Works. Where somewhere you have the example that see that you have a mock appraiser, we might need to look at the reality of public works. The presentation is also such, part of its generic nature, where you articulate the responsibilities of auditees, the officials in the relevant entity, what they must do, and then the various options. But when I say that you need to come back to have a specific engagement in regard to the responsibilities of members of parliament, their oversight role and engagement with the Department of Public Works, and then be able to highlight the issues. For example, what was the state of play in the Department of Public Works? The last time the audit was conducted, that factual information will be there. There's no need for a hypothesis. And then say, how do we take forward the material aspect that they addressed and the material aspect that you highlighted the last time, which have not been addressed, and other issues that have been picked up, and which are the areas that members of parliament have to engage and look at. So that's another aspect that we have to come back to make it real to the work that they have and the responsibilities that they have. Others, I would not want to pretend to answer for you, but just to say that auditors in general, when they audit anything in private, in government, they will emphasize that they hone in on a particular body of information. And the audit opinion that they express is in relation to that which they've been able to cover. But they also absorb themselves that, say that, on the basis of information that has been provided, this is the opinion that you can come to. But it does not mean that they look at the entire organization, all the records, and check whether in each and every material respect the body, the entity, complies with the laws of the country. So they normally say that they've taken a sample, and the emphasis is a sample of information, and then they express their view in regard to it. But the other issue is that the general public who drinks would be more common sense related questions, like why did you say this? Doesn't it cover the entire thing? That's perhaps a good opportunity to give you all a chance for a rejoiner. You have noted the Mark's comments and honorable members made. So let's have that first engagement of your rejoinders and replies there too. So whoever is first off the hook, thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. Indeed, all these valuable questions and remarks. I ask my colleagues to go for me to sit and slide as I go along. Yes, Honourable Members, I can see the eagerness for the committee to engage with the public works specific aspects. Now, there's a delimitation that we have indeed. And if you look at those the slides with the time frames of when what happens, if my colleagues can just quickly go to that slide. We are at a point now where entities must, by legislation, table their annual reports in Parliament by 30 September, I think next week, Tuesday. I checked this morning, and the public works report has not yet been tabled. If the public report had been tabled in Parliament, I would have allowed to share with you the outcomes at least on a high level today. So that's what we normally do, is I check before our presentations, like in one of the other portfolios, all the reports are tabled, and I could actually share at this point in time during the presentation with the committee members the outcomes already. Therefore, we will come back in October for the B-RRR process. And in that briefing, we're going to give you a debriefing document. In your case, it might be even 20 pages, where we will take you through the history of all the outcomes of the department and the other entities associated. It was not only the department that you exercise oversight about, it's also the IDG and some other public entity that you exercise oversight about. So in that document, we are going to cover all those entities. We are going to cover the three-year audit outcomes. You will see what the key issues were. You will see if there were any improvements in audit outcomes. You will see if there were any regression in audit outcomes. We will discuss with you the root causes for those audit outcomes. If you look at the slide, there's some point where we talk about the briefing process, and we say in that slide that during the briefing process we will be discussing the root causes with the committee. That will help the committee to formulate a resolution. We will also be making recommendations in that document, and during those discussions we will be discussing those recommendations. So that will all be assisting the department to making resolutions. And normally what transpires during that process is that after we made our presentation, you now understand what are the audit issues, what are the resources for those issues, then there would normally be engagement between the department and the committee. Then the resolutions will follow. And then the ideal situation is that throughout the quarterly monitoring process, the committee will then focus on those resolutions. And typically what you need to ask the auditees is for an action plan to improve on the audit outcomes. And then in your quarterly review process, you will ask the entity, come and present to me your progress against your action plan. Can you give me comfort that you've now dealt with the issues which previously led to a negative outcome? Tell us about your quarterly performance on your predetermined objectives. Are you meeting your targets? Can you give us assurance that you've got proper systems in place to collect the information, to be able to report on a reliable basis on the performance in your quarterly report? So those processes will definitely follow. That's why we also have the slide with the process to say these are typically the time frames that we will be engaging. I thought that puts members to ease the those engagements, which is in fact a couple of weeks from now on, one tabling at the place that we will do this. So it's a process. Today is to get to know each other, for Thomas to understand what is the key process, and I'm very glad there were some very, very good questions that I'm going to deal with now, which deals with the audit process is actually itself.
That's just before you deal with the other aspects. I would also like to remind presenters, because you deal with the material on a daily basis, you have a number of acronyms, BRRR and what is. For somebody who's engaging with you in Springamandi and Parliament, walk slowly, unpack what you mean by BRRR and all the other acronyms, and we also get used to them. So whenever you make your slide presentations, make sure that all your acronyms are unpacked so that even after the presentation, somebody can sit down and recap. The best practice is always have the BRRR full, and then the first time you use it, then within brackets, the abbreviation, then the person can follow. Thank you. Continue, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Yes, the BRRR is a basically review and recommendation report, yeah. And that's why my colleague focused in the one slide, and I'm going to go through that slide quickly with a commentary again, because on one slide we focused more specifically on the budget project, but I'm going to take you through it again now. The Honourable Member asked a good question to about the difference between realistic and relevant. So focus in the performance information is what you have in your, you start off with your strategic plan. And I'm going to mention one of the other questions that the member asked about situation where an entity might not have sufficient budget to execute the strategy. Now, if you look at that slide on the screen there, this is the process currently applied in South Africa. So we've got policy development at a high level. Then each and every entity, now if you look at policy development, we will have a national development plan, we look at state of the nation at least, we look at 14 outcomes, and that will form the basis of the strategic plan of each and every entity. So each and every entity, some entities mandate is driven by legislation. So that entity will then first of all touch each legislation, because you can only do what is allowed in terms of each legislation. So that entity will take a combination of what is the legislative requirement, what is the, in terms of the outcome that it needs to contribute to, what is the, in terms of the national development plan that it needs to contribute to, and what is the, in terms of the state of the nation that needs to be contributed to. And that entity will then go and develop a strategic plan. The strategic plan then goes through a review process as well. And one of the review processes is that those strategic plans will actually come to this committee for your portfolio. You will review those strategic plans. And therefore, very important phase in your review process, because it's at that point in time where you need to ask yourself, are you comfortable that this entity is doing what it is supposed to do? Are we comfortable that the objective set in the strategic plan and in the annual performance plan, or whatever performance plan, a strategic plan is a long-term plan, ideally a 5-year plan. Your annual performance plan is what should be done in that specific year. And that's directly linked to the budget of that specific year. So, and you see the next phase is operational planning and budgeting. So, you have got your strategic plan, you've got your operational plan, what needs to be done in this financial year. Now a budget needs to be developed that would enable the execution of that strategy and that annual performance plan. And it's very important during this committee review process, you need to get comfort from management that there is a link between the strategic plan, the annual performance plan and the budget. Because if you have activities that are not in budget before, you might end up with a situation that at the end of the year, when you look at actual performance, the entity might not have achieved some of the objectives, and the explanation in the annual report would be due to various constraints. Can you see there's a disjuncture which should have been picked up in the earlier processes and which should have been corrected then already? Because if it's a matter that you cannot get the budget, if there's no budget available for National Treasury to execute something in your strategy, you have to change your strategy. It doesn't help to have anything in your strategy which is unfunded. Because it means that you're making a promise in your strategy which will actually not be executed. Therefore, the review processes are very important. Now, due to transfers, the new committee now gets involved at a point in time where most of the strategy part has been published already. And it's now the point where you have to look in the budget review process more focus on the budget. So the budget should then be in that top right-hand angle. Understand the mandate, understand how the National Development Plan and the State of the Nation is doing exactly what Solar Plans offers in. Clear link between the budget and the annual performance plan, do I have to explain to you now, adequate funding for the strategy, and then, very important, have a look at last year. Have a look in the annual report, to what extent did they achieve last year's strategy? Did they use all the funds last year? Because some entities underspent. Have a look in that, because in the annual report they need to explain the reasons for underspending. So look at last year's annual report, or the annual report that's going to be tabled now before end of September. Have a look in that annual report, if there were underspendings, what is the reason for the underspendings? Then when you do the budget review process, you need to focus on that. You need to get comfort from the entity that they've got now making the mechanisms in place to actually in fact do spend the funds that have been allocated. And very important, those funds must be spent for the intended purposes. Now key in developing these performance indicators that get included in the annual performance plan, that's where the SMART principles comes in, and that's where the honourable member asked the question about relevance and reality. So relevant means whatever is set as a target, they must be relevant to the mandate of the entity. So if you can use the example in your environment of the Expand Public Works program, it's relevant because it's one of the key initiatives for the Department of Public Works. When it comes to realistic, it means that number of jobs created target in there must be realistic. If you look at the context of how much funds is available, because if you set a target and the target cannot be met with your available funds, then it's not realistic. So that is the test that should be applied in terms of realistic. Because if you put unrealistic targets in there and they're not funded and they're not going to be achieved, then actually you are not successful in delivering on your mandate. I think I've addressed the question about the budget link. So very important in your review process for the committee to make sure that you're comfortable that all the activities are actually adequately funded. Now there is a difficult year. An election year is a difficult year because what happens is that the TG plans have been developed just before the elections. They get tabled in Parliament around about April, May. And now there's the new leadership. So it's possible now that there might be in some areas a request to change the strategy. So what is very important now is that those changes need to be developed and agreed as soon as possible so that whoever is the accounting officer or accounting authority knows what is required, that budget shifts can be done as far as possible. Now if you look at, for instance, the National Department, a National Department accounting officer has got some authority to shift budgets within 8% per program. But now in November, in the adjustment estimate, bigger shifts can be made. So if there's major shifts that need to be made, the strategy needs to be concluded also that those major shifts can be made in the adjustment estimate. One do not want the situation where changes in the strategy is only agreed very late in the year, February, March next year. First of all, it's too late to change the budget. It's too late to actually change the mechanisms. And then you identify that, find then the entities will report on activities that were actually never formally approved in terms of the strategic plan. So very important when the committee engaged with the property to understand, is there any major change in strategy? Has this change been made formally in terms of the strategy? Has it been approved by the executive authority? And has this change been made in terms of the budget? So that was a very, very key question. Can we look again to the slide that deals with what we as auditors do and not do? And I think the chairperson answered the question very well, on LDR. It's important to understand that as auditor general, we use the international standards on auditing. So it's standards which are used worldwide. And that's important because that gives credibility to the audit process. Now the audit process is a process to give you reasonable assurance. It unfortunately cannot give you 100% absolute assurance. And I can link this to another slide in the presentation as well. The one that deals with the audit process. So we follow what we call a risk-based audit approach. So in any environment where we audit, we do a planning and we determine what are the key risks in this environment. And then we focus on those areas. We cannot audit each and every transaction. No audit process audits each and every transaction. We do have to audit on a sample basis. It leads to another question. Yes, it's possible but remember, the primary responsibility for accuracy and completeness of the financial statement is that of the accounting officer. Yes, it's possible that the accounting officer and the auditors can miss something. That is an unfortunate reality that happens in private sector as well as in public sector. So you will sometimes think to find that when you have a look at the set of financial statements and the audit report, you will see management will refer to a note in the financial statement. There will be a note in the financial to say, during this year's compilation of the financial statement, we picked up the error that we made last year. And then they will explain in the financial statement what is the error and how they corrected the error and what is the impact of that on the financial statement. We as auditors will normally, if it's material, sometimes it's not material. If it's material, and the concept materiality basically means when so significant that it will impact on the users of the financial statement. So when it's material, we will actually in the audit report have a paragraph that states, refer to note 20 or 25 or whatever note in the financial statement, and take note that the entity has made some adjustments to its financial statements which refers to the previous year. So even on compliance with laws and regulations, there are many laws and regulations that entities have to comply with. So again, we follow a risk-based audit approach and we focus on key legislation for that entity. So therefore, we cannot give absolute assurance that each and every piece of legislation in the country has been complied with. And we focus on the key legislation. Key legislation, that's why we've got it in our presentation. We focus on the Public Finance Management Act. We focus on the trade regulations. We focus on the entities' own enabling legislation. Like I explained earlier on, there are some entities which actually got its own legislation. So we'll focus on compliance with that legislation. And then you will find that there's lately for the last couple of years a lot of focus on compliance with supply chain management related legislation. And that's typically your legislation is not complies with that renders what we call irregular expenditure. And in our future engagements, we will have a bit more discussions about irregular expenditure to understand what is the nature of irregular expenditure, what is behind irregular expenditure, because there's various non-compliances that can lead to so-called irregular expenditure. And then also we need to focus the last couple of years on human resource related regulations, laws and regulations. And you will see when those legislation have not been complied with, we will also report on that in the audit report. Now, in our next session, this will become very clear to you when I'm going to take you through those very
from this in your environment. When it comes to four, in terms of the international standards of auditing, it is not a primary responsibility of the Auditor General to detect fraud, or from any auditor to detect fraud. I think that is very important to understand. If we do pick up what we call fraud risk or fraud indicators or even fraud itself, we then make sure that it gets dealt with in an appropriate manner. But it's not the primary responsibility, but in an environment where there's a risk, then we do also focus focus on that risk. When it comes to performance information and service delivery, currently the audit approach with performance information is a requirement of an entity to report its annual report on its performance against predetermined objectives. So if we use an indicator once again in your environment, let's say there's an indicator that you create jobs through the Exchange Public Works Program, and the target is that 100,000 jobs in a specific sector should be created. That will be the target, and the entity will then report on the actual achievement in its annual report, and it might report 95 jobs created against the target of the 100,000. We will then go and audit to see if we agree with the 95,000. That's currently how far we go to that extent. We do not go further at this point in time, and that's why we are saying there is not necessarily a link to service delivery. Sometimes there is a link, but it's not necessarily always a direct link. Remember, entities sometimes report underperformance. So in the case of underperformance, and it's a key performance indicator, it will actually automatically tell you the service delivery was not to the desired extent, merely because the actual target has not been achieved. Then there was a question about what is the AG currently doing in the current environment to assist auditees. Our current strategy is, it might change going forward, but our current strategy is that, and can we go to the key controls slide, please? Our current strategy is that we go in each and every environment that we audit, and I think there was a specific reference to municipalities. We go in each and every environment that we audit, and we go and assess the key controls on a quarterly basis. Now, those are on a very high level what the key controls are. Those few lines that you see there actually get broken down into a multi-page document. When we focus on day-to-day control, do you do day-to-day reconciliations? Do you have an asset register? Do you do regular asset counts? But also, as you can see, start at leadership level. Do the leadership do the right things that would enable a positive audit outcome? So we do those assessments in each and every environment that we audit quarterly. We then share those assessments with management. We share those assessments with counselors, with board members, with CEOs, with audit committees. Remember, an audit committee is issued at the governance part. An audit committee is a very important governance system, because part of what an audit committee needs to do is to make sure that entities do their own risk assessment. Entities do have internal audit sections, that those internal auditors focuses on key risks in that environment, and that the internal auditors report on the control environment, and that report should primarily in terms of the legislation go for review by the audit committee. And the audit committee should then take action and make recommendations to make sure that the controls are enhanced. We also give feedback to mayors and to ministers on these assessments that we do. So the program has got two legs of it. The one is to actually go and do the key control assessment. The other one is to communicate it through our visibility programs. We will also make recommendations. So once again, all the leadership should be fully aware on a regular basis what do they need to focus on. Anyway, the question about clean audit, can we go to the clean audit side, please?
think what's important to note is that that's why we use the word the good administration / clean audit. Just a terminology that we use for entities that have got no significant items in the audit report. In other words, financially unqualified. Financially we are happy, there's no issues from a financial point of view. No material findings on laws and regulations, and no material findings on performance information. So the clean audit term is just a term that we use to say, so in an environment where in those three areas that we should be focusing on by law, and if there's no material findings in all of these three areas, so you go to the audit report and you look at all three of those sections in the audit report, there's nothing to report, what do we then call it? And that's just a terminology that we've linked it to say, then in that case we call it a clean audit. So you can get an unqualified audit report, financially unqualified, with other findings. And you will see when we discuss your portfolio's audit outcomes, we'll package it for you later. So we can have unqualified, which is good, but there might be findings on non-compliance with legislation, or there might be findings on performance information. And then we would say it's unqualified, but with findings. Ideal situation would be to have what we call a clean audit, that there should be any material findings on any of the three current categories that we have to report on as the audit general. Honourable Chairperson, members, if I've missed any questions, please just remind me, I'll gladly come back.
Thank you very much, sir. May I suggest that we just have a 10-minute break, people to get tea, and for yourself to regroup, caucus, your way forward. This very cheap one says, just a minute shy of 11:30. So shall we be back here by 12:20? Then it gives you time to wrap up, and then 12:00 we take the financial and fiscal commission. Thank you, good folks.
The vision of that is something else. I understand what you said. But I just also want to ask you about the organization. What is the organization? Could we put our legislation now if we have to audit? But then, and that's why we had to apply to say, what should we do over and above council? And so we have to explain now these people to all the things that we do. Our legislation doesn't have any agreement. That we go and do it because we want to contribute to changing the environment. So,
thank you.
remember we were also at the city procedure, and these images that are outlined there in our community suggested. So I suggest that you, if you're not can help us, have a look at our annual report. So we set our legal objectives, and you're right, the greater impact is actually in the study, because that's what we're looking for, you're saying, but if I look at all the outcomes, we don't see it in such a study, but what I need to understand is that there is very little players in the environment, if you go to the slide, there is what environment is showing. It's actually part of the data and management, so we can help them, we can tell them what we think they need to do, we can tell them where they go along, we can tell them which one goes along. But this management should act on it. If management do not do what they're supposed to do, there's other role players in the portfolio contract. In other words, if you see that in your environment, there are some things changing in the project working on, then it's also focused on what you have to do. But all of you know they're helping you. You know, you might have a question there. What's the leadership? Why are you doing the project? So a lot of people that you know, we can assist, but that's unfortunately how far you can, how far we can go. And if you get our general report, the one that we bring out again, there we go again, we unpack and we can take the information and what is in place. So people do not do what they're supposed to do. They do not perform what they're supposed to do. That is our consequence of all the legislation. Here you see, there should be one. Not for the work of the people who give you that that's where the good project will keep coming, that's where the other leadership will be, the mayor, the director, the local town, the artist industries, premiers. But I don't know how many people will be afraid of them, because the life leadership are okay. But in fact, obviously, we measure, if you look at our demo report, we measure red, green, and yellow. We want everything, that's why it seems to be so convenient. We want everyone to be able to get
Thank you.
Goeiemiddag, om te vloederig, want kan maar weer gesels. Meneer Doren kan maar jylle stuk klaarmaak. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. There was one question that I did not respond to before the break, and that was just to go back a bit to the three E's, economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. And let me give you some background here, something which some of the committee members might relate to. What you follow indicated in her presentation was that performance audits are not mandatory audits. So either that's the audit of performance information, which is a mandatory audit which we must do because it's in the annual report of each and every entity. Performance audits we do when there is a specific need for it, and then there's focus on a specific area. Now, one of the most recent ones that some of the members might relate to is the one that was issued larger by the Auditor General that dealt with the use of consultants. So, the focus on during a performance audit is on economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. Economy basically means, did I acquire what I needed to execute the program at the best price? It's the easiest way I can explain it. Did I get
eat at the best, but that I get the best goods at the best price. Efficiency is my input versus my output. In other words, did I use the right number to get to the right number of input to get to the right output? And then effectiveness deals with, do I achieve my objectives? So I put in all this money that I actually achieve the ultimate objectives in the end of the day. That is, for me, the easiest way to explain to members the three E's. Did I get it at the right price, the best price? What my mix right to get the right input? In other words, did I only use one bag of cement to get the mix right? Or did I put in two bags and I actually only needed one bag? There's of course also what sometimes happens in some environments that I've only put a half a bag in, which means I can go out standing there, and then a year later it has to be demolished. So then I wasn't effective also because I didn't achieve my objective, or for instance housing delivery. Easiest way to explain.
Let's speak about bags of cement. So I'm taking up to what this priest said. It covers like wheat bricks. And I didn't see any brick in there.
Thank you, Jefferson. Honorable Jefferson, I think that is what we wanted to present today. If there's any additional questions, we'll gladly deal with it. Like I said, I think we're also looking forward to our next engagement on the budget review process. As soon as we've got the date, we will make the document available to the committee a couple of days before the time, so that members can already read through it, because that's quite a thick document. But I would really suggest that you take some time and read it. We're trying to put it in a manner that you will understand the issues, and then it can be much easier for us to engage, because during that engagement we use very limited slides, because there is about the real essence where we need to discuss the issues that is at hand. So it's very difficult to do that with the slides. So we'll show you the outcomes on a high level, but when we talk about a specific issue in the audit report, that's covered in the document with the root cause, with the recommendation. So it's a bit of a different engagement, and if members have had the time to engage with our document, it makes that in engagement so much more valuable. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Any further additions? None. I'm very happy that you have earned your living, and the two ladies to your right, the gentleman on your left, have not yet earned his living properly, but we are happy to see. Members, if there are no further comments or questions for the Auditor General's office, then we'll proceed to our next presentation. So as we said, with regard to the Auditor General's office, our next engagement, we'll talk about it before the actual engagement, so that we see how we plan and the focus areas of interest that members might want to be covered. So by the time we get together, then all the parties know exactly what to expect from each other. We'd like to thank you, but obviously the engagement of our work is such that we stay in touch with you on a continuous basis. Where we need to ask something, we'll knock on your door and ask for the requisite assistance, because we made it very clear to the department that we'll hold them to account for all the issues that fall under the remit of our responsibility.
So in order for members to be able to give effect to that, we will need all your assistance to do so. Thanks. We'll now take the brief by the Financial and Fiscal Commission. You provided us a list of names here, Mr. Kumalo, acting chairperson, Dr. Ramos Mabugu, RRP director. You'll have to unpack for the committee what RRP stands for. And then Mr. Dawood and Mrs. Peters. You are all welcome, good folks. So as soon as you are set up, you'll commence with whoever needs the input. Yeah. And then you just identify as to who to, so that people can put faces to names. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members, for the invitation to engage with your committee at this workshop. My name is Bongani Kumalo. I'm the Acting Chairperson and Chief Executive of the Financial and Fiscal Commission. I have brought with me members of the Commission Secretariat, which is primarily from our research program. On my left is Dr. Ramos Mbuku, who is the director of the research program, the RRP, the Search and Recommendations Program of the Secretariat of the Financial and Fiscal Commission. To my right is Alex Dawood. He is a program manager responsible for provincial budgets at the FSC. And next to him is Ms. Sasha Peters, also a program manager responsible for national budget at the NSC. The two colleagues here are based in our Cape Town office, which is just down the road on the Church Constitution House. And Dr. Mabugu is based in Midrand offices, which is our head office. Now, first of all, would like again to express our appreciation on behalf of myself and the Financial and Fiscal Commission member for the invitation. And I've noticed that there's a few members in the committee that I've met before in their different capacities who have an understanding both of what the Financial and Fiscal Commission is, but I think there's some that we haven't met, and so we will try and speak a bit to the Financial and Fiscal Commission itself and its mandate and its role, what it does and what it does not do. The first thing to do is to explain that the Financial and Fiscal Commission is established in terms of the Constitution, Section 220. And functions in terms of primarily the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act of 1997, amended in 2003. There's also a number of other pieces of legislation that give a mandate to the Commission, and those are all related to Chapter 13 of the Constitution, which is what I can loosely call the Fiscal Constitution of the Republic. The Commission consists of 9 members. 2 members are nominated by organized local government. three members nominated by provincial government through the Forum of the Premiers, and the balance of four members appointed by national government. The whole appointment process is coordinated by the Minister of Finance, who makes recommendations to the President for the appointment. So the Financial and Fiscal Commission is appointed differently from the other chapter line in similar or associated institutions that are established to support democracy. It's the same principle that establishes the commission, but the appointment process is different. The primary mandate of the commission is to make recommendations and research in chapter 13 of the constitution, and those relate to the annual division of revenue, equitable division of revenue amongst the three spheres of government. And those recommendations are made to parliament, provincial legislatures, and any other organ of state determined by legislation, strictly speaking, by national legislation. The commission's focus is on the equitable division of nationally collected revenue among the three spheres of government and any other financial and fiscal measure. So organs of state are free to request the commission to conduct and provide them with recommendations on any fiscal and fiscal matter in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, which is the act that enables the commission to exercise its mandate. The legislative provision, for example, that might be enacted, or decisions that might need to be implemented that have an effect across or on one or other of the spheres of government. If those decisions have an effect of a financial or fiscal nature, then the commission needs to be consulted in before that piece of legislation or regulation is enacted or accepted or gazetted for the commission to make its own recommendations on mitigation of any of those financial and fiscal matters that would actually apply to the different sphere of government. So if the commission's recommendations have not been sought in that process, that action is considered to be legally invalid. So it's a principle that is built into the constitution to try and avoid situations arising where we end up with unfunded mandates. Basically, that's what it means. It's a lever against unfunded mandates. So the commission must be consulted in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act by any organ of state. Now, our current research strategy is informed primarily by the National Development Plan going forward, and we are looking at the developmental impacts of different types of government programs and different types of government policies. That's the main primary focus now. How we support the government policy is through working primarily within the intergovernmental fiscal relations system and identifying any challenges or weaknesses in current existing structures, whether they are coordinating structures or they relate to the financial and fiscal matters. We look at those and we conduct evidence-based kind of research to inform.
Just a second, please.
No, sorry. No, I'm sorry about that. Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations System is what is meant by IGFR. FFC means the Financial Fiscal Commission. I think those are the two acronyms that I've used as well. Okay, I will remember that going forward. Now, we interact and participate within the forums and institutions responsible for intergovernmental fiscal relations policy. That means the Technical Committee on Finance, the Budget Council, and the Budget Forum. These are primary institutions that coordinate financial and fiscal matters across the three spheres of government. So with the Budget Council consisting mainly of the Minister, is mentioned in the Fiscal Commission and the NEC is for finance in the nine provinces, with the budget forum extending the budget council to include organized local government, and the minister and NEC is responsible for what is now cooperative governance and traditional affairs. The Technical Committee on Finance is the technical structure that supports those principal or political structures. We also disseminate information through invitations that we receive on our annual submission. Each provincial legislature and organized local government will take a briefing on annual submission. I think we brought copies just for your information of our submission for the 2015 Division of Revenue. We table our submission 10 months before the minister tables Division of Revenue Bill and the budget, which basically means that we kickstart the budget process of any particular cycle. And then we also interact with various committees within Parliament. I think it's important here that I contextualize this in terms of the principal stakeholder for the Commission. The principal stakeholder for the Commission is the legislatures, so in Parliament and the provincial legislatures. So the work that we do is meant primarily to enhance the work that Parliament does around the financial and fiscal matters of the state. So we basically are at the service of Parliament because we are established for that purpose. So it is quite proper that in the request that I received, Chairperson has actually requested us to also speak about what we can assist with for the committee to support oversight function and also in the preparation of the budget review and recommendations report or BRRR report. I think we are actually well within the same wavelength in that respect. So the recommendations of Parliament, I think I've already spoken about this slide, but what I need to highlight an important matter that arose with the election of the money bills management procedure related matters, that is that through that piece of legislation was also established the Parliamentary Budget Office, which is a structure that is supposed to provide capacity on the budget process and money bills within Parliament. So it's not a parliamentary structure that provides that capacity for members. Now, we have been in constant discussions with the parliamentary, first of all with Parliament before the establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office, and subsequently with the establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office, we have played quite a significant role in some of the conversations and development around that. But we have to make sure that we have that conversation so that we don't actually duplicate each other's work in Parliament. We don't present a picture that seems like we are competing with the Parliamentary Budget Office for space. So we have identified very clearly what role the Parliamentary Budget Office plays in terms of its mandate and what role the Financial and Fiscal Commission acts playing in terms of its own mandate, but also, more importantly, how we can complement each other and be able to provide a better quality of service to Parliament as we move forward. We all know that at the moment that Parliamentary Budget Office is not yet fully capacitated, so its focus at the point in time is probably on a limited number of committees. So part of the work that they would ordinarily be doing of assessing the budget on an annual basis would actually be, it would take some time for them to be able to do that across for all Parliament committees. We, on the other hand, would have to do part of that anyway in terms of assessment of the effectiveness of how the various departments have performed or have utilized resources that have been allocated to them, obviously in line with the provisions of Section 2142 of the Constitution, which look at the process of the division of revenue being driven by, among other things, the efficiency with which resources are actually utilized. So that's an area that would create space for us to actually engage together with the Parliament Budget Office, because for our own purposes and purposes of feeding back that information to Parliament, we would actually require to do that. And so our recommendation is that primarily on the division of revenue are actually tabled in May, and the minister on tabling the budget and the division of revenue bill in any particular year must then respond to those recommendations formally. So he tables the response to those recommendations with the budget documentation so that Parliament can actually look at that, and if there's a conversation that must take place, which is what some of us actually at the Commission expect, we can then have that conversation. How does FSC support Parliament? We do have some direct training programs that we have developed for Parliament and also for other legislatures in the other spheres of government, and we have examples where we've actually done that kind of training. We also have a non-training support and intervention through our own programs of public hearings on particular matters that are of concern as far as the intergovernmental fiscal relations is concerned, and that basically we have listed some of the public hearings that we've had in the most recent times, that like 2013, some of the reports those reports were basically tabled then. Some of them have already been fed into some of the reviews that are currently taking place, especially with respect to local government fiscal framework and local government infrastructure review processes that are taking place. We also, through our own engagement, like engagement that we're having with you today, we obviously there is a discussion that is taking place or that can take place that might lead to this particular committee then requesting the Commission to bring back or come back with a very specific matter that the Commission would like to give. So those are kind of indirect means or methods of actually sharing information and empowering the Committee around. Now, in terms of what you consider to be the value add is that we can provide advice, we can analyze, we can train to assist the work of the Commission. We have specialists in intergovernmental fiscal relations, which we can also talk about. I think it's important to look at what government does now in that context, because some of the key challenges addressed in the National Development Plan are the lack of intergovernmental relations in general. Now, intergovernmental fiscal relations is just part of that process. Now, if we are going to be looking at outcomes going forward, and we're looking at an outcome-based approach, obviously issues of intergovernmental relations become quite critical at any level of the legislature. So while it might not be a necessary issue for the committee to start questioning what is happening in a municipality, the necessary issue to start questioning what is happening in the broader area of job creation and public works, and everyone, because policies are there, these other spheres must actually implement. So there's some degree of concurrency, even if it's not direct, it's actually related to how institutions must actually operate ultimately. So we do have some challenges, for example, that I can put to you that we have realized, and that whilst at the provincial level you've got good legislation that relates to asset management, even though you probably are not getting full value around that, but you do have legislation that governs that. When it comes to local government, there's no legislation that governs, which is like Kiama, for example. You don't have that when it comes to local government assets. And what we then have is like municipality is basically using regulations to deal with some of these issues, and we've got serious challenges with the still state assets because it belongs to government, and they are unmaintained, they are deteriorating, and some of the results we are beginning to see. So it's those kinds of issues that we can actually be able, as the FFC, be able to bring to you, and we can have some conversations with you around. I think, Honorable Chair, let me stop here and allow Dr. Ramos Mabuku to and his team to take you through the rest of the technical issues that we need to share with you.
Thank you for your introduction, sir. Good doctor.
Morning, Honorable Chair and morning members. What we will do for the rest of the presentation is to pick on three specific parts that we thought Honorable Members would benefit from. I'll start by going through some recommendations that we've made in the past that we think are still relevant for the Department of Public Works. Then my colleagues will go into more detailed departmental analysis of how their budgets have been running and what we essentially add into the analysis from Financial and Fiscal Commission is that we don't analyze budgets at a point in time, but we open up the window wider by going at least 3 years back, look at the trend, and then project 3 years forward. So my colleagues will go into that analysis. Then we'll end up by looking at a public works department at the official level and see what kind of a story is coming out, and then we'll give you our assessment of the development in audit reports and outcomes and how we view from the Financial and Fiscal Commission where the fault lines are from our perspective. So to give members that data analysis of cross-line relations where you don't simply rely on one input but are able to look at inputs of your various organs. Now, starting with the recommendations that we make, which we think are still in the pipeline, way back in 2010 when we were making our response to the divisional revenue bill, we raised an issue again on the expanded public works program incentive grant for the social sector. And back then in 2010, our argument actually was that this was a grant which was way too innovative and way ahead of the time. In other words, it was the bells and whistles of how incentive grants should look like, but it is not an architecture to handle that kind of a sophisticated incentive-based grant. So we welcomed that grant, but then made a recommendation to develop very carefully, particularly the employment framework, to use to assess the outcome of that particular grant. Subsequently, the wage issues that were raised by certain provinces where there was a problem in that transfer from the grant were taking place outside of the ambit of the Division of Revenue. And as a result, appropriating those transfers was problematic from an accounting perspective. So all those issues enabled the incentive grant, EBWT incentive grant. Now our current analysis is that provinces do still have challenges with this particular grant, particularly relating to how to handle labor intensive infrastructure, which affects a lot the spending. What happened in 2011-12 is that the Department of Public Works appointed the service provider to assist the provinces and municipalities to design such infrastructure grants. It was still waiting to see the outcome of the work of that service provider to assist with unblocking that. The next recommendation we made was in response to the medium-term budget policy statement for 2011 around the expanded public works incentive grant, and then the issue was other expenditure surrounding that that particular grant. And what we notice currently that the committee may want to again follow up with is that from our analysis that we'll go through, that problem has existed from the recommendation in 2011. Now when you're going to actual expenditure against this area, it's still a big problem on how to deal with the allocation that has been made against this grant. Then when we responded to the Regional Revenue Bill in 2012, we again reiterated our recommendations around the EPWP incentive plan. And the main innovation made in 2012 in the recommendation was that there should be a full evaluation of that grant in terms of what it has achieved. The response from government to that recommendation is still a work in progress. A committee was set up, Committee of National Treasury, Department of Public Works, Department of Cooperative Governance, and South African Local Government Association. And they have been working on this recommendation. And so it's an area that the committee can again look at and check on the progress with that review work around the grant. Then way back 2009-2010, when we made a submission on the Division of Revenue Bill, we found a need for reporting on the expanded public works program outcomes. That is actually more specific. Particularly, we called for an equity focused reporting on the incentive grant in terms of gender disaggregation of people that have energy from the trackers in terms of whether disabled or not disabled. So, and government's response was they responded by accepting the recommendation and then said they will look into ways of feeding in some of that information through the framework and the other means of feeding through that recommendation. So that's another area around how one reports around the grant table. Make quite clear the equity and gender aspect of who is benefiting from the incentive grant that is still in the pipeline. Then the earliest recommendation that we had made in 2006, in our 2006 annual submission for the Division of Revenue, was when we were gearing up for public works to do with preparation for the World Cup. Scheduled for 2010. And then recommendation we made, we are seeing bits of it now beginning to feed through into system. The recommendation was that there should be quite a clear strategy on how the legacy public works that have been put in place in the context of the World Cup are going to be managed at an event. Then government report was that municipalities should bear the cost of maintenance of those public works. But now we're beginning to see a lot of cracks with that approach think it's an issue that needs revisiting, thinking about when we host mega events and a lot of public work, the budget assets that are built, how are those implemented, and the approach of fitting that down to municipalities or provinces obviously still needs to be tied, and it doesn't work automatically. We are seeing now with the assets that we put onto the ground. I'll ask my colleague Sasha to take us through the department specific budget analysis that we never follow to assess the department.
Thank you very much, Dr. Madam.
Thank you, and good morning again, Chair, members of the committee, and other colleagues. As Dr. Mabuga indicated, I'll take you through our analysis of the Department of Public Works with budget and spending trends, and just an overview of the general performance of the sector. So in terms of contextualizing the Department of Public Works, the department is guided by three main aims. Firstly, it's to provide for and manage accommodation, housing, land, and infrastructure needs of national departments. Secondly, it's to lead and direct the implementation of the National Expanded Public Works Program, or EPWP. And then finally, to promote growth, job creation, and transformation in the construction and property industries. In terms of the structure of public works, it's a concurrent or shared function between the national and the regional spheres of government. And then in terms of the department's contribution to assisting in the achievement of national development plan goals, the department has indicated that it can assist the implementation of job creation initiatives, and this explains through its EPWP program, which aims to create 6 million work opportunities by 2018-19. It's also indicated that it contributes to the transition to a low-cost carbon economy, and this is through the adoption and implementation of the Green Building Framework. And then it also contributes to the development of an inclusive and integrated rural economy. And the other focus is on how the department disposes of state-owned immovable assets in rural areas for developmental purposes. To further contextualize the things that you'll see coming out of our analysis, we thought it would be useful to go through some of the high-level key challenges that have been hampering the performance of this department. So, firstly, just to note that due to a consistent trend of poor audit outcomes since 2009 and generally just poor performance in terms of meeting set targets, the department has had to implement a turnaround program, and that was implemented as of 2012. And this turnaround program defines a process of organizational review that will ensure more compliance with the departmental mandate and improvements in audit outcomes. So some of the key challenges which the turnaround project will address include the lack of controls in supply chain management, and this has been identified as a major risk by the Auditor General. The AG has noted that the capacity within the department to process tenders is virtually non-existent, and the resultant lack of financial controls and mismanagement has provided fertile ground for fraud and corruption. So what we noted is that, for example, irregular expenditure amounted to 171 million in 2011-12, increasing in 2012-13 to 874 million. But just to note that a service provider has been appointed to assist with the fundamental review of the whole supply chain management system within the department. The second area that has proved challenging for DPW has been lease management. We noted that a total of 40 irregular leases were being investigated. This is according to the 2012 annual report. And the regularity with which the numerous irregularities with respect to these lease agreements have given rise to legal risks, opened the department up to legal risks. But the department is in the process of reviewing all of its lease agreements, and of the 2,778 leases that were reviewed in 2012, The department found that 1,316 of those required attention in terms of either revision, cancellation, or reporting renewal. So just giving you a sense of how poorly these management has been in the department to date. The third big challenge confronting DPW is the fact that its asset registers are not accurately reflect state assets. And this is a big challenge given that DPW is the main custodian of state removable assets. And this is one of the key factors as well that has resulted in the department receiving negative audit opinions. In terms of progress, the department is in the process of rebuilding its immovable asset register and also building a model to revalue these assets. Then finally, like many other departments, DPW has also encountered difficulties with attracting and retaining skills within the department. And this has also been exacerbated by the fact that generally the built environment and property management industry is suffering from a shortage of skills. And the department has noted that it is operating with the Department of Public Service Administration and Higher Education and Training to try and address this skills deficit. So we wanted to share that it would be useful to give members an idea of how we approach our analysis. And just for example, you could look analyze government budgets by comparing different votes, so looking at what Department of Public Works gets in relation to other national departments. You could compare different programs within a vote. So within public work, you could look at, for example, what the EPWP program is relative to the administration program, which is what we'll have a look at. You could go deeper and look at a sub-program analysis. So within the EPWP, what are the different sub-programs within that program? How are they performing? You could give a provincial overview where you look at how different provinces are performing. So what is useful is looking at what the department intended to achieve and also what they have achieved in a particular year. So give you a good measure of the performance of the department, and we'll also look at that in a couple of slides time. So the tool or measures that we've used in our analysis, we've looked at percentage share of the total budget. So for example, what are the biggest programs consume the majority of the DPW budget. You can also look at changes of growth in budget, and these can be done in various ways. You can look at percentage changes, so DPW program has increased by X percentage relative to another program. You can look at these changes on a year-to-year basis in terms of growth rate. One of the value adds of the commission is that we like to focus on real changes in budget and spending. So the nominal figures are what you see in all your departmental, especially budget documentation. But when you factor inflation into the effect of inflation, that is when you refer to real figures. So that is one of the value adds of the commission. And then also looking at what's driving the changes in budget and spending and performance. And then I think Dr. Mabugu indicated that we look 3 years back and 3 years forward, so we provide a good sort of review period. So moving now to the actual theme, what you can see is that from an allocation, if you look at the last row of that table, from an allocation of just over 7 billion in 2011 and 2012, budget declined to around 6.6 billion in 2013. And this reduction is due to a number of reasons. It was due to the phasing out of the devolution of property rates funding grant. Previously, the department used to pay for property rates on behalf of its clients, but that was devolved to provinces via conditional grant. So part of that reduction is due to the phasing out of that grant. The reduction in budgets allocated is also due to non-completion of various projects. So underspending and when a department understands the originating letter, cutting the budget for the following year. And then also the reduction in the allocation was used, cabinet approved reductions, and you just said bulk tightening that we saw a number of departments subject to. So over the 2014 NTF period, we see that the budget starts to regain its ground again, moving back to the 7 billion mark in 2016-17. But we note that much slower growth is projected over the 2014 medium-term expenditure framework. And when we talk about 2014 medium-term expenditure framework, we're talking about 2014-15, 2015-16, and 2016-17. This figure graphically illustrates the real year-on-year growth in the allocation to the department, and you can see a big just between 2012-13 and 2013-14. And then you see from 2040 onwards, you see some recovery in the budget allocation. We now look at the budget composition across the program. So of the five, there are five programs comprising the DPEW budget. The largest is a Easy Movable Asset Management program. And we see that by the end of the 2014 NTF period, which would be 2016-17, this program will consume just under half of the total DPEW budget. The key purpose of this program is managing government removable property portfolios, so it focuses on things such as rehabilitation of state buildings, ensuring that state buildings are easily accessible to all, including people with disabilities. So you can understand why it consumes such a large chunk of the budget. The second largest program is the Expanded Public Works program, which consumes just over 50% of the departmental budget. And this program is key in context of government job creation efforts. The administration program starts out with consuming about 20% of the budget, and this is basically due to the fact that the funding for the turnaround project that I mentioned earlier to improve the performance of the department, the funding for that project is located under the administration program. But you'll see that as that program wraps up by the end of the NTF period, the proportion of the budget consumed by administration drops down to around 16%. We've also analyzed the DPW budget by economic classification, and it's just another way of looking at the spending of the department in terms of current versus capital type spending. And what we see is that the largest item is transfers and subsidies, and this is due to the entities that sit under the department's and the monies that transfer to these entities, as well as the transfers to provinces and municipalities via conditional grants. If you look at the real year-on-year growth, which is the five last columns, you'll see that the allocation in terms of transfers and subsidies dropped by 40.8%. I put a circle around it, and that was again due to the phasing out of the devolution of property rates fund grant to provinces. The increase in spending on goods and services in 2013-14 is driven by spending on consultants, and this is due to a shortage of technical skills in property and project management. And also skills that were required in terms of the department's turnaround project. If you look at the growth in payments for capital assets, which is that last row, you'll see that it's very erratic. It declines by 35%, then by 20%. And this is not unique to the Department of Public Works. In analyzing the capital budgets of a variety of other departments, we see that coming through. Departments experience challenges with managing the capital budgets. We also looked at spending performance of the department, and here we looked at the extent to which the allocated budgets were spent. And what we see that is overall, the department underspent its budget in 2011-12 and 2012-13, so those are the last two bars in that figure. In 2011, underspending was driven mainly by the EPWP program. I should note that in 2012 we see a marked improvement in spending on that EPWP. And in 2012, underspending is driven by a result of poor spending in the property and construction industry policy regulation program. So it's because of this sort of persistent trend of underspending that reductions were affected to the budget of the Department of Public Works. Then she will also assess the department's in-year spending performance. And the reason why we look at in-year spending is because it gives us an idea of how the department is managing its cash flow and its disbursements. And what we note is that in 2012-13, the spending is very erratic. If you look at the blue line, it goes up, down, high peaks and low troughs. And that just indicates that the department is not managing its cash flow very stably. We see an improvement in 2013-14, which is very fine. So not the dividend. But still, we think that the department could do more to stabilize its cash flow and disbursement. We also want to just provide a snapshot of the two biggest programs on the budget, and that's the Innovable Asset Management Program and the EPWP Program. And what this slide shows is just the real growth rate of the sub-programs that comprise the Innovable Asset Management Program. This is the department's largest program, and trends that you see overall for the department are largely driven by the trends that occur in this particular program. So it consumes over 40% of the total departmental resources. Now, if you look at that first sub-program, it's called infrastructure. That is the most critical component and relates most to the department's core business because it funds the acquisition of infrastructure for use in implementing the department projects. So we see there a big decline of 53% between 2011-12 and 2012-13, that first column. And this is due to the non-completion of projects that occurred in 2011. So non-completion, underspending, and then the year after, the allocation was reduced. Further declines in the sub-program are due to the reprioritization of funding. So when the department implemented the turnaround program, it took funds from this particular program and diverted it to the administration program to fund the turnaround project. Then also, what we see is that the total program growth declines over most of the period. I think the take-home message from this slide is just that the trends are very erratic. You again see these big increases, big drops, and whilst there may be reasons for it, it's about how the department is able to absorb big increases in 1 year and then, you know, adjust to big reductions in the year thereafter. So it's about the erraticness of these things that you're seeing. This slide then shows some programs that make up the EPWP program and how they have grown or are projected to grow over the 2014 MPA period. The EPWP program consumes just over 30% of the total department budget, and the key objective of the program is to ensure the creation of work opportunities. Now it does this through two sub-programs, the Expanded Public Works program. The EPWP program focuses on creating additional employment opportunities through the use of labor-intensive delivery methods. In terms of performance, we see a big increase in 2012 and the 2013 financial year. And this is due to the appointment of service providers to support provinces and municipalities in the design of infrastructure projects and how they report on it. If you recall, Dr. Nagu spoke about how provinces and municipalities are having difficulties in incorporating these large labor-intensive projects. So the department provided some support to the subnational skills. The second sub-program is actually the largest sub-program in this program. It's a performance-based incentive allocation. So what this program focuses on is disbursing funds to provinces and municipalities, also NGOs, to ensure creation of work opportunities in specific sectors. We see increases in 2012 as well as 2013, and this is due to additional funding that has been allocated to the program. And overall, between 2019 and 2012-13, the program has created just over 3 million jobs, which equates to about 68% of the initial target at the Department of Health, for example, 4.5 million jobs. This figure illustrates departmental performance in meeting the targets that have set for itself. So what we did is we looked at the 2012-13 annual report. We looked at the targets that, initial targets that were set and then the extent to which they were met. So we divided them into targets achieved or exceeded, targets partially achieved, and targets not achieved. And you'll see there that the number of targets that are partially met or unmet is quite high. There are various reasons for this, but it could be that the department is setting unrealistic targets. The AG spoke about the representatives from the AG spoke about that earlier. The next slide details the reasons why the performance is so poor. So for example, with administration, there were 39% of the targets were unmet, and according to the department, this is due to delays. Delays were caused due to lack of capacity, high vacancy rates. They admitted that in certain instances targets have to be looked at in terms of the budgets that they have. Lengthy procurement processes have also delayed the appointment of service providers carry out some of the projects. If we look at the last program, which is the construction and property policy regulation program, this program focuses on legislative type aspects within the CDW, and the reason that the performance is really poor there is because a number of, for example, the legislative framework for the built environment professional, there was delays in internal consultation, so that cannot be fully wrapped up and classified as a part of me. We also just provided an overview for members of the DCW audit outcomes from 2009 up until the one that's currently available for 2012-13. And you can see that from 2010 onwards, there has been some kind of improvement if we look at the fact that there were disclaimers and now we moved to qualified work findings. So there has been a bit of an improvement. But according to the AG reports, the key issues that need to be addressed are inadequate internal controls, particularly in the areas of leadership, financial management, performance management, and governance. And these are some of the aspects that the turnaround judge is focusing on. Chief, I can hand over to my colleagues to get us through the final legal presentation.
Thank you very much. Heading to the final leg. Not the moment. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Good day, Chairperson and Honorable Members. The session is going to look at some of the findings in relation to provincial departments of public works. Now, the table we've got there looks at the audit outcomes for provincial departments of public works for the period from 2004 up until 2013. And when we look at the results, what we find is that there's been no significant improvement in the audit outcomes of provincial departments of public works. For example, in 2012-2013, four out of the nine provinces either qualified opinion or disclaimer. And over a period of 10 years that we've looked at, only three provincial departments of public works received an unqualified audit opinion, what is commonly referred to as a clean audit. Importantly, 2012-2013, the first time the Provincial Department of Public Works received a clean auditor or unqualified audit opinion since 2004 to 2005. Now, some of the reasons that the AG raised in terms of why provinces have not achieved the clean audit are instability in leadership and lack of human resources. There's effective internal controls. Action plans that are in place are not implemented timely. Fixed and registers are incomplete and inaccurate, something that we've also picked up at national tier. Also, there are incomplete disclosures with regard to the regular process and waste expenditure. And then finally, appointments that are made by National Department of Public Works to intervene or to provide support were not funded. The Commission's also viewed that while certain oversight bodies such as the legislature, provincial legislature, have important role to play, this does not detract from the fact that the National Department of Public Works needs to take a leadership role in terms of improving the outcomes of the sector as well. Now, the departments of the National Department of Public Works are responsible for two EDWE conditional grants that are transferred to provinces. And as the transferring agent in terms of the Division of Revenue Act, the Department of Public Works has a legal responsibility in terms of determining the eligibility of the grant, providing support to provinces, auditing the performance of provinces, and also reporting to National Treasury on the progress that is being made. Now, if we look at the performance on these two conditional grants, firstly, the two conditional grants, the one is the EPWP extensive grant, and the other one is the EPWP social sector grant. Now, if we look at the first figure on the left-hand side, the EPWP extensive grant is the one that is in blue, and the social sector grant is the one that is in red. And we looked at the period in 2019 to 2012-13. And what we noticed from the figure on the left is that when we look at the percentage of the total budget spent, provinces are unable to spend more than 80% on the EPWP extensive grant over the 4 years. In fact, in 2012-13, they managed to spend 80%, which is higher over the 4-year period. And in relation to the social sector grant, while spending has been relatively good, it's noticeable that in 2012, the grant performed inadequately in terms of spending, which spending was approximately 57% of the total budget. Now, although these two grants are considered to be small grants in terms of the allocation of resources compared to some of the other conditional grants that go to provinces, it should be noted that the unspent funds on these two conditional grants are quite significant. So, for example, if you look at 2010-11 and 2011-12, close to 120 million rand was unspent on the EPWP incentive grant. Now, the main reason why the EPWP incentive grant has been performing quite poorly is generally that provinces have challenges in relation to infrastructure, which affects the spending on performance on the grant. Also, in many instances, funds are withheld because provinces are unable to meet the conditions within the Division of Revenue Act, thereby leaving funds unspent at the end of the financial year. Just some concluding remarks is that what we note in terms of the performance of the Department of Public Works is that there has been underspending in key programs as well as not meeting targets. Now, the underspending and not meeting targets are symptomatic of underlying issues within the department, especially with regard to leadership, capacity, as well as planning as well. Now, the Commission is of the view that for the sector to turn around the goal, not just at the national level, but also at the provincial level, the Department of Public Works needs to play a leadership role to provide the necessary support to provinces, as well as enforcing minimum modern standards to facilitate improvement in service delivery at the provincial level. The Department of Public Works also needs to make sure that it puts proper systems in place to guide expenditure management, as well as appropriate setting of key performance indicators as well. seen facilitating progress, and some of the improvements noted, but there are some improvements that have been noted. However, there is still a while of fast to go in terms of putting the Department of Public Works on a more stable footing. Thank you, Chair. I'll now end over to you.
Thank you to all the presenters, members of Parliament, your opportunity for comments, questions. Let's start with Honourable Mrs. Adams, followed by Bob Masama.
Thank you, Jesus, and thank you for the input that you got from the FFC. Mine is on the immovable asset register. Do you think, Commission, that a chairperson is there perhaps is the poor performance on the immovable asset register? Can it be attributed to the fact that we have here a function of concurrency between the national and the provincial Department of Public Works? The other thing, Chairperson, is on slide 5, the appointed service provider, is there any term for them? Does the Commission, the FSC, assess the appointment? Because service providers are there to support the provinces and the municipalities, the performance of the EPWP, as we have seen in this graph here, the social performance are doing very well on your slide 17. Is doing very well. What is attributed to the fact that in 2011-12 there was less debt on the conditional grant of the EPWP? What attributed to that step in, I think, in 2011-12? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member Paul Maclan.
I just want to find out, is it the same with the legislature? How the legislature also the parliament does on this one?
Microphone. phone there. It was a very harsh background sound. I think you let him, you let him. Okay, that's fine then.
Okay. Yes, okay.
That's the move.
Yes, Chair, thank you very much. I just want two questions. When you talk about the fiscal policy of the country, how does the commission led to setting up that policy? Do you have consultations with maybe the Treasury, with the State Bank? Maybe what I'm trying to find out is just what's your role in terms of setting up fiscal policy of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir. Mama said, a wolf on his feet and cut.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you from the presenters of today. It's not easy. What we are not yet. We are still learning, but you guys should be the part of the activity. And number one, my question is on, in fact, it's not the question, it's just a comment about the tender. I don't know. I don't think the tenders are good because they are caused some problems. It's on page 8. On the key challenges confronting DPWs. The lack of control in supply chain management, identified as a major risk area by the Auditor General, DPW's capacity to process tenders eroded and has led to numerous instances of fraud and corruption. So I think I'm a tender now, I didn't like it, I'll call you. And then it is a footy, and then, in the cases of the issues of the provinces have been achieved. Outcomes for provincial departments of public works have not considerably improved since 2003-2004. Four out of the nine provinces received a qualified opinion in 2012-13, over a period of 10 years. That is 2003-2004 to 2012-2013. Only three provincial departments of public works received an unqualified budget opinion. I just want to be clear on that. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Member Shabonga. Well, my son, could you want another opportunity? You had it.
I don't know now. How come it was such an idea that the commission was done? Is there anyone else now who is doing that?
I suspect the media Makoti is strong.
Yeah, I just want to go to the same people. You know, there were things that they were talking about were found actually in 2009 and all those things. And you are seeing actually dispensing this money to provinces not within Dora. And you didn't give us some sort of explanation or remedy to say what should be done. Should they be stopped or what? I didn't hear then, because you complain that it's not in accordance to what some provinces complain that they can't appropriate them. But you didn't tell us actually what should be the right way to for this incentive to be given to provinces. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Can we get take a rejoinder from the presenters on the Western school comments made? Thank you.
Okay, no, thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members, for the questions and comments. I will respond to a few and then I'll hand over to my team to elaborate on some of the technical issues that you have raised. Let me first of all respond to the issue that was raised by Honorable Adams. The first issue that you raised relates to whether the challenges with respect to the vulnerable asset register have got anything to do with current or currency or fraction. Yes, that's part of the challenge. And one of the issues that they are raising is an issue of improved intergovernmental coordination. Without that improvement in intergovernmental relations, which is a key finding of the using the diagnostic report of the regional development plan, basically came up with that as the key issue that is missing in the intergovernmental relations. There are obviously other technical issues that relate to some of the challenges that the department and also the provincial departments are faced with, that have been highlighted as some of the internal challenges to the department that are actually there. The second question that you asked is related to whether the Commission has any role or does assess the service providers of departments. No, we actually do not do that. That the assessment is supposed to be done internally. But one of the issues that we raise in a more broader sense in our, I think it must have been our submission to the Division of Revenue for 2007, where we started raising issues around government needing to introduce independent expenditure reviews for departments. Ultimately, when you use service providers, you are actually spending money. So I guess that you will be taking a briefing from the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, because at that particular point, the response that we got from government was that probably the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation would actually be the department to look at that. And we know that they have actually started the process of evaluating that. The Public Service Commission, because it has to deal as part of its mandate with the overall efficiency of the public service, then part of its work would actually involve the work of the consultants. And Dr. General obviously has started a process where he's raised issues relating to how much you are spending on consultants. Now, if you have to look at it from an efficient point of view of public service, the Public Service Commission should be able to come in and see why is it. Is it because we don't have the capacity? And if we are using those service providers, are we using the same people that are actually supposed to be sitting in this department that they've actually moved and set up their own campus? Because these are issues that are real. So you will have somebody now who is incapacitated in the department. You have a person who was there, who left, who then set up a company, or consulting company, then comes back to do the same job. These are things that are actually there. So part of the issues as well that are raised by the Minister of Finance when he talks about cost containment measures and the need to actually plan on the use of consultants and being able to do that involves plans that this department will have to be able to interrogate and interrogate the annual performance plan this committee will have to look at when you interrogate the annual performance plan of the department. So because it's part and parcel of cost containment measures, part and parcel of what the auditor general is expected to have looked at in conducting the audit. In fact, those cost containment measures were effective in December of 2013. And the instruction to the auditor general was that they have to be part and parcel of the audit process for that financial year. So which basically means that the audit reports that you are getting now will be able to show and demonstrate part of some of the issues that you are raising around the performance of the service providers or consultants. I will leave the best question to the team to respond to in your list of questions. And there were three questions that you raised. Honorable Masango, when we say the Commission must be consulted in terms of the Financial Assistance Commission Act, the first stage of consultation is when the executive decides to prepare, whether it's a legislation or it's a regulation or it's a rule that will have this kind of implications for the other spheres of government. That's where it should actually start, because we need to be consulted for the financial and fiscal issues arising from that proposed decision or executive action, so that we can advise the Minister of Finance. And if it's a bill that must come to Parliament, the Parliament in processing that bill must also be able to look at what the Commission's recommendations were and how everything is considered in that particular process. So, in instances where the FFC has been bypassed, because we have parliamentary liaison office, sometimes our parliamentary liaison officer can, through our own processes, check some of these things that we have bypassed and they bring it back, then we are able to bring it to the attention of Parliament. There's a problem here because the Commission was not consulted. But it does happen that in certain instances this thing can actually happen. And then by the time we pick it up, it's at a stage where legislation has been passed or it's on final stages. And then that presents a challenge because either you take the process back to the beginning or you say Parliament must decide whether we must actually deal with it at this particular point in time or deal with the consequences later. So what we try to do is to try to raise awareness of the existence of this piece of legislation that basically protects the different spheres from potential unfunded mandates that result from legislation or rules and regulations or even instructions that are made through certain secondary pieces of legislation. So it's a process that basically Parliament as the institution that processes legislation will have to be aware of that when there are financial and fiscal limitations. But in most cases you find that departments do these things and they have a section where they put the memorandum to the bill. They will actually say financial and fiscal implications, they will say none. But you know that this legislation requires that you must establish a certain office within your municipality or within your provincial department. You need to staff that with it so that you can actually implement. So you can't say none in that kind of instance, because the assumption tends to be you will get an automatic adjustment in your equitable share, because now when you have this or calculus, for these things will respond just like that. Now, in times of fiscal austerity, even those words we no longer should be using, but we have this fiscal consolidation process that we have, money is not always available. So if somebody passes a piece of legislation that requires another CEO government to enact or to comply, and you don't actually provide, now provinces don't raise any money, for example, there are some municipalities that regulate that depend entirely on transit. We can't assume that the transfer system automatically responds to that requirement. And so we need to be able to put those levers so that we can actually be able to say, okay, this is how we're going to deal with this in times of fiscal tightness or tight fiscal framework. But if money is available, then it's a different set of issues that we can actually deal with, because we can make those adjustments immediately. So that's why sometimes things have to be phased in terms of when they become effective. So you phase it over a period of time, so that's the response that you can have. Now, okay, in terms of the report that government must make to the Commission's recommendations, government's response is to Parliament, basically. It's not to the Commission. It's to Parliament, because those recommendations are made to Parliament. So that response is to facilitate a conversation between government and Parliament. So if Parliament differs with government in the manner in which the recommendations have been fed into the process, the Parliament can have that conversation and call Commission together with government to have that conversation. And the kind of misinterpretation that tends to happen is one that says that National Treasury takes the Commission's recommendations seriously. Now, our response to that has always been that we don't make our recommendations to National Treasury. We make our recommendations to Parliament. National Treasury must process on behalf of government those recommendations, and the minister must then respond to those recommendations to Parliament. Obviously, the minister will have a conversation with the Commission, and it's a process, part of the budget process. So Parliament ultimately is responsible for ensuring that if government's response is yes, we agree with you, then let's see that action from Parliament's oversight effective. What is it that has actually been now put in place that moves us towards that particular recommendation? I think with now with the Money Bills Procedure Amendment Act, that bill basically, that act now basically provides Parliament with even more leverage, because it also requires Parliament to respond. It requires the Minister of Finance to respond to those budget review recommendations reports that must be processed by the Finance Committee and the Appropriations Committee. So that response, you can see it in a document called the budget review, where we have said something that impacts on public works or on education, and Parliament has taken that and says, no, we want this to happen this way. Even those ministers respond to the Commission's recommendations or something else. You can find those now beginning to come through that process, and then the conversation taking place. So I think this particular piece of legislation has given a little bit more instruments to Parliament to actually deal with a particular type of issue. So there's no requirement for Parliament to come to us and say this is what we think. But Parliament can, of its own accord, decide to say, come and talk to us about this and explain to us why you're saying that we do. The issue around the punitive and incentive element of the grant, these are really matters of a grant design. I think one of the issues that Dr. Mabubu was raising was that the grant was well ahead of its time. Now, if you as department motivate for a grant, and then, because you must be responsible for the design of the grant, how it's actually going to operate, and how you are actually going to ensure that the allocations that are made will actually be spent. Now, if you are an accounting officer in a national department and there's an accounting officer in a provincial department, then these are two separate people. Now, an accounting officer, or what they call transferring officer in respect of the Division of Revenue, a transferring officer will not basically be able to say directly to the accounting officer in a province, this is what I want you to do. The only thing that you have is the grant framework. It's the legislation that you must actually apply. Now, if things are not happening in progress and you are keeping this money, there's no need for you to transfer it when you know very well that it's not going to be spent. you transfer it, you make yourself look good. So we can look at your numbers and see that this is how much you transferred. And so you look yourself, make yourself look good. When we get down to the province or the municipality, we find that no, actually this money is not being spent, it's actually sitting there. So these are issues that relate to how you define the grant. And in instances where some money has not been spent, whatever, Section 216 of the Constitution must come into play. And so to try, what we're trying to do now is try to link some of the provisions that you built into the Division of Revenue Act with some of the requirements around 216 so that you can actually be able to link these things from an accountability point of view. And so that's one of the critical points that's on the table in terms of reviewing the framework and the design of some of these grants. Coming to Honorable Mobile, fiscal policy and the role of the Financial and Fiscal Commission. The Financial and Fiscal Commission does not actually have a role with respect to policy, any policy. Our role is to basically ensure that when government makes policy, we are able to assess and say, how are we going to fund this? Because these are issues of mandate. So if it's a policy that will impact on the mandate of each sphere of government from an equitable resource sharing point of view, then we have a role to play in that, in that respect. But otherwise, we take government policy as given. We then go back to our constitutional mandate and the rights that guarantees in the constitution for South Africa. And then we say, if you do it this way, what must happen to the funding arrangement and how will that impact on the rights of South Africans and the mandate of the different states of government? So the long and short of it is that we don't have any role in the policy space.
Honorable Solti, you say your questions were comments, but
let me welcome the comments. But you're really hitting the nail on the head. So it's not just about tenders. It's about the whole supply chain management process. What is coming out is that there are lack of internal control, there is lack of capacity within the department. And those, so the tender issues are just but one part of the process, because when you have no systems in place or you have inadequate systems and controls, then issues of inefficiency, basically propping and issues of tender and corruption then start to feed into it. They feed out of that polluted environment. Yeah, let me stop there and I say it's a few things that are technical.
Yes, there were two questions relating to the EPWP grant. There was a request just for clarity in terms of the three provincial departments of public works that received an unqualified audit opinion. In terms of the classification of the AG, I classify, as you heard this morning, the department as being unqualified with findings, qualified adverse or disclaimer. Now, the dock pollution is those departments that received an unqualified audit opinion, referred to as a clean audit. And if you look at that table there, we see that there are three instances. One, departments received an unqualified audit in 2003-04. One department received an unqualified audit opinion in 2005, and then again only in 2013. So between 2004-2005 to 2012-2013, there were departments that received an unqualified audit but with findings. But no department received an unqualified audit until 2012-13. Then there was a question that was asked about the reason for the low spending of the EPWP social sector grant in 2011-2012. In 2011-2012,
as we can see the red line, the spending on the social sector grant was 57%. Now, in terms of some of the reasons, there are a couple of reasons why the social sector grant underspent. Some of the reasons was that there was actually a delay in approving the incentive agreements as well as the business plans. So many provinces, because of a lack of capacity, did not have sufficient personnel dedicated for the EPW social sector grant, especially in terms of making sure that the agreements have been signed as well as the business plan approved as well. And then also, because the transfers take place via the provincial treasuries to the various departments within the province, there were poor communication between the provincial treasuries as well as the provincial departments with regard to allocations that must be received between the different departments within the province. And therefore, because of these misunderstandings, transfers were delayed and in some instances stopped due to non-compliance.
Thank you. I'm sure the murmur of your stomach will be telling you that it's lunchtime. And we have a sit-down lunch in Marksburg. I'm not sure if there are any further questions and comments. I thought that it might be advisable that we dispense with whatever questions, then we will need to come back. So when we go for lunch, we have our lunch and then we go our various ways. I'd also like to say to members that tomorrow we will not be having a session. There are a number of policies and things. So we'll have to restructure what we wanted to achieve tomorrow to another day. So tomorrow we will not be continuing as the committee. Today is the end. So if there are no further questions and input from members, and what remains for me is to thank presenters, stakeholders for the interest, and here to say, like I said, with regards to the other presentation from the Auditor General's office, that the nature of the work is such that it will need continuous engagement by ourselves with you in order for us to be able to better do our work with your assistance, which we'll take on. So everyone concerned, thank you very much. We'll now break for lunch, and this is the end of our meeting. I thank you very much, folks. So lunch is dedicated to the table there. Mark's Building Restaurant. Yes, sir.
I didn't say before the meeting.
Yes. Oh, okay. Then we'll have to take your presentation after lunch. What I'm concerned about the dining hall, because it's two. So let's take lunch and then we'll convene and take your presentation. Yeah. The time is 1:30 now. Can we come back at 2? Doesn't take us that long to eat. We don't need the whole hour, otherwise our meeting will dissipate. Let them come back at 2:00 and listen to Department of Planning and Monitoring.